From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. At least a dozen people have been arrested in connection with Saturday night's attacks in London that left at least seven people dead and dozens injured. ISIS has claimed responsibility. Joining us now is BBC security correspondent Gordon Carrera in London. Gordon, what more do we know, or what more are the police saying about the attackers at this point?
Well, the authorities do know the names and identities of the attackers, but they've not released those to the public. That's why they continue to their investigations. They're looking for associates. They don't want to necessarily tip those off. So they've kept those names quiet, but they have certainly identified them. We think it's quite likely that some of those may have been known to the authorities in some way in the past, which has been the case with other attacks recently as well. The investigation seems to be pressing ahead with the sense that most of these are individuals who are based in the London area.
So they were citizens, or they were legal residents of the UK?
They appear to have been, yes. I mean, it looks like the center of gravity, if you like, for this plot was domestic. That's what the police are indicating. These aren't people who came from abroad to carry out this attack.
Is there any way to judge the ISIS claim of responsibility? Is it being seen as credible?
Well, ISIS does have a track record of claiming things which they didn't actually play any part in. I think in this case, it's been taken with a bit of seriousness, partly because I think the expectation is that these might be people who were inspired by ISIS. Now, whether they were actually directed by ISIS, did they have direct contact with the group? I think that's less clear. The methods they used in this attack, though, the use of the vehicle, the use of the knives, also actually the fake suicide vest that they were wearing, that is all things that ISIS has called for its attackers to use. And it just put out a message a couple of days ago linked to Ramadan, calling for attacks using vehicles, knives and guns as well in English.
Is there a visible increase in security in London today?
It's not as visible as it was after the Manchester attack. In that case, the military was put out on the streets to relieve the pressure on police, and you saw soldiers at prominent locations, Downing Street, embassies and so on. That has not happened in this case because the threat level hasn't gone up to its highest level critical. Now, that indicates that the authorities at the moment are not aware of any remaining threat from this group. And that means that some of those extra, more visible security precautions have not been put in place.
But the Prime Minister, Theresa May, says that more needs to be done to fight extremism. What is she talking about then? I think people who've been to London know that there are cameras already everywhere. There are police all over the place already.
Absolutely. And I don't think it's so much about those physical security measures, interestingly enough. I think she's much more talking about a longer term strategy. So it is, for instance, trying to do more to tackle extremist ideology in the country and to deal with that. It's about trying to tackle extremist ideology on the internet and trying to put pressure on tech companies, for instance, to take down extremist propaganda, which is inciting people to action. It's in some of those areas where I think she's placing the emphasis, rather than, if you like, in protective security and policing.
Is she likely to face legal hurdles in doing anything on those fronts?
I think it's primarily political. We're obviously in the middle of a general election, so there are political questions about who will form the next government anyway after the election on Thursday. And then there are issues about whether, in some cases, for instance, with the technology companies, about whether Britain has the ability to get them to do what it wants. It's not so much a straightforward issue of legislation.
Well, you mentioned the election coming up. Is there fear that this attack and the attack in Manchester are going to taint the election in one way or the other?
Well, there was a few voices saying the election should be delayed, but very few. Almost everyone has thought it should go ahead. Part of that idea of showing resilience, showing that democracy will be not be knocked off, knocked aside by an attack like this. So in that sense, I think the election goes ahead. I think what's interesting is that an election which everyone thought would be dominated primarily by the issue of Britain leaving the European Union and what kind of deal there would be is now becoming much more about security. And today, particularly, there's been issues about police numbers and what kind of powers the security and police service forces should have. So it's changed the election, I think, rather than necessarily tainted it.
Gordon, London is famous for keeping calm and carrying on with daily life, even after things like this. But is there anger among people at these terrorists, at people who may have helped to radicalize them, if that is found to be the case?
There is anger, and you always get that after a terrorist attack. But I think the mood is still much more resilient, as we have been here before in London, whether it was the July 7th, 2005, when we had multiple suicide bombings on the tube, or if you go back further with the IRA bombing campaign in London. And so I think there is that attitude of the thing to do is to keep going.
That's the BBC security correspondent Gordon Carrera joining us from London. Gordon, thank you.
Thank you.
Well, let's turn now to Portland, Oregon, where yesterday 14 were arrested at a rally which had been billed as a Trump free speech rally. Trump supporters on the right demanding their right to free speech. Anti-Trump protesters also came. Things turned nasty.
This is the Portland police. This is an unlawful assembly. You must disperse the area and leave the street.
Well, Jeremy Joseph Christian attended a similar rally weeks ago. He's the man officials say was the train attacker who stabbed to death two men who came to the aid of young women Christian was verbally assaulting with racial epithets. For many people of color, that knife attack was an escalation of things they've heard and felt for years. Molly Solomon of Oregon Public Broadcasting reports.
Rachel Macy says she heard the man before she saw him.
Who was saying that he was a taxpayer and that this was his train and that people of color were ruining the city.
Macy is Native American, a member of the Klamath tribe from Southern Oregon. She was on the MAX train when a man began screaming racist things at two teenage girls and other passengers and stabbed three men. Two of them died. Macy fears the color of her skin could make her a target for other racists.
Every time I have to take public transportation, just walking down the street, I realize I don't want to be noticed. And I am afraid.
That fear is shared by many of Portland's communities of color. Umutula is a college student. She moved here from West Africa with her family. They're black Muslims, and sometimes she wears a hijab. Umu says most of the women in her family are not taking public transit right now. Those girls on the train who were harassed, that could have been her.
When you go out there, you have to, like, really be careful because I don't know what's going to happen. It's scary. It really is scary.
Mohamed El-Sheikhi is a stand-up comedian from Libya who moved to Portland 3 years ago for school. He says his father called him from their home in Benghazi after the train attack.
He was like, hey, I've been seeing Portland all over the news. Stay safe. And I was like, this is the most ironic thing that ever happened to me. Like a man who lives in the middle of a civil war is asking me to be safe in Portland.
Like many in the city of Portland, El-Sheikhi sees the stabbing victims as heroes. But he wonders why other hate crimes haven't garnered the same attention.
A lot of people of color have been killed before in this city by a white supremacist or by the police. And now that two white people get killed, now people are like, oh, people are being murdered here. I'm like, yeah, but this is not the first time.
The TriMet attacks are just the latest in a string of racist incidents across the region. In March, a white man burst into a Middle Eastern restaurant in Salem, yelling, "Get out of America." And in Troutdale, an Iranian refugee found his home ransacked and covered in hateful graffiti and threats. According to the Southern Poverty Law Center, in the 3 months after the election of Donald Trump, Oregon had 50 reported hate incidents.
This is not something that's just recent.
Garrett Hongo teaches creative writing at the University of Oregon. Hongo, who's Japanese-American, says there is a history of harassment against people of color in the Pacific Northwest. He remembers being followed and nearly driven off the road by a car of white men as he was coming home late one night from a fishing trip in central Oregon. Another time, his son was chased through the streets of Portland by white supremacists.
These things have been ongoing and people of color know about them. An unfortunate thing is it takes a murder to bring attention to these issues.
Despite its reputation as a progressive city, many minorities say they're not surprised when they hear about hate crimes. With Caucasians making up more than 76% of the population, Portland is the whitest major city in America. That's partly because the state was built on exclusion laws that made it illegal for African Americans to enter or live in Oregon. At one point, Oregon had the highest per capita Ku Klux Klan membership in the country. 19-year-old Alexis Bright is a fourth fourth-generation African-American from Northeast Portland. She says she often feels like she faces a different reality from her white peers.
As a person of color, especially in a predominantly white society, you are very aware of these dangers that a lot of people can comfortably ignore, but for you, it's in your face every day.
Having to constantly deal with that can be exhausting, says Zahir Jan Mohammed, who is a policy director at the Asian Pacific American Network of Oregon. He also co-hosts a podcast on race and food called Racist Sandwich, where the issue of Portland whiteness is a frequent theme. Jan Mohammed says the lack of diversity can be isolating for people of color.
I know people who leave. It's heartbreaking because there's so many great things about the city, and yet people don't feel comfortable here, so they leave.
Jan Mohammed himself plans to leave Portland this year. For NPR News, I'm Molly Solomon in Portland.
Ibsen's A Doll's House scandalized audiences when it first debuted in 1879. It questioned the very roles of men and women in marriage, with Nora at the end walking out on her husband Torvald and their children with what New York Times critic Ben Brantley calls the door slam heard round the world. But now, more than 130 years later, the Dora knock heard, well, at least on Broadway, as Nora re-enters, returning after 15 years. She's not exactly greeted with open arms. In A Doll's House Part 2 from playwright Lucas Naith, Nora, played by Laurie Metcalf, returns to ask Anne Marie, the family's longtime maid, played by Jane Houdyshell, to help her get the divorce she never got from Torvald. But Anne Marie, who had a deal with the wake Nora left behind her, is not happy. And a warning, while in 19th century costume, her anger and language is very much modern day.
After all the problems I've already fixed for you, you want me to fix this too? Is that what you're really saying? F*** you, Nora! F*** you! You have zero gratitude! I raised your kids. You should be coming in here. First words out of your mouth should have been, thank you, Anne Marie. Thank you for abandoning your own life and your own child and raising mine so I can go off and do my little thing.
A Doll's House Part 2 has been nominated for 8 Tony Awards, including a Best Actress for Laurie Metcalf and one for Chris Cooper as well. He plays Torvald. They both join us from the NPR studios in New York. Chris, you there?
Yeah, I sure am.
And Laurie Metcalf, welcome to you as well.
Thanks, Robin.
And Laurie, I have to start with you. This character, this outsized character, what did you think when you first considered playing her?
Well, I never got a chance to play Nora. And so when I saw the title of this play, cheekily named by Lucas Naith, the playwright, as Doll's House Part 2, I thought, I bet this has some humor in it, and I bet it also has some real guts to it. And when I read it, it sure did. And I thought, I wanted to reinvent the Nora Helmer that we remember from the original, because this is a Nora now who has reinvented herself, right? Because she's been gone for 15 years having experiences that she never would have been able to have during her marriage to Torvald.
She's an author. And, you know, the humor surprises Chris Cooper because that's a heavy topic, you know, a mother leaving a family.
You would think it's a heavy topic, and it is. It is. But it's looked at through so many different angles, and every angle that you look at it through has a validity.
It's like the original Kramer versus Kramer. You know, you think of the film of, again, a modern-day depiction of a mother leaving a family, and your sympathies are pulled. But where are yours, Laurie Metcalf? I mean, again, you know, this is a Nora who felt stifled in the original play, and she was. I mean, she had no freedom. She was practically owned by her husband.
Well, Torvald had no freedom either. I mean, I think Lucas likes that Henrik Ibsen wrote about confinements of a marriage and role-playing in a marriage and how society expected it from everyone who entered into a marriage. She was just the one who made a change. It's still a very, very complicated issue. We're doing it 138 years later, and the fact that Nora comes back into the house, how could she possibly have, let alone been successful, but what has she learned and what has Torvald learned as he's taken the past 15 years to simmer and think about the last argument they had before they split.
And it's definitely, this whole play kind of in a nutshell, is an examination of rules of society and gender. And to go along with what Laurie was saying, Torvald had a terrible tendency to stifle himself. He was so concerned with what society would think, and I think he cut himself off socially once Nora left. He was left to raise three kids, and his existence seemed to me to be his work at the bank and home. I hate to say it, but kind of a gloomy guy.
Well, and as Nora likes to point out to him, Torvald, you're constipated.
He makes himself constipated. He does it to himself.
Well, let's listen to a little of a scene with the two of you. This is further on into the play, and now you're addressing past hurts as well as present ones. A couple with a history, but who haven't seen each other. It starts with Laurie. Nora, let's listen.
Also, here's another thing that bothers me. You don't get angry.
Of course I do.
Maybe once you
Right now I feel angry.
Right now you're angry.
You're damn right I am.
No, I don't believe that you are angry, that you're in it, that you're inside the feeling of feeling angry. I think you're just outside of it looking at it like, oh, there's some interesting thing. You don't act. Constipated.
Oh, shit.
There's that word again. Chris Cooper, the great Ben Brantley quote about your performance, he calls you a stoic time bomb who's still wondering why he was never allowed to have that conversation with Nora that she seemed to long for in their last moments together 15 years earlier. That's a part of it as well, that he seems confused about, why couldn't I be the man that she wanted me to be?
Well, I won't disagree about it. Over the years, he has collected points to argue. When they face off, yes, he didn't know how to express himself to Nora. He, again, so shut himself down, he didn't confront the problems that were before them. Now, at this 15 years later, when they're face to face, they have the opportunity to tick off the different things that drove them apart. And if they would have faced them and talked about them and spent time with them, they may have saved the marriage. Mm.
Laurie, I didn't know, but thank goodness for Wikipedia. Ibsen actually based this, A Doll's House, on the life of real friends of his, a couple, Laura and I think Victor, and they had some of the same problems that Torvald and Nora ended up having in A Doll's House. There was a financial problem. She had to write forge a check for money. In real life, when Victor, her husband, discovered about a secret loan that she got, he had her committed to an asylum. You know, very sad. But she did return to her husband and children, and she did become an author. And when you are thinking about her, how are you either the real Laura, what a terrible story, being committed, or Nora, the fictional woman, feeling she had to leave, walking into this abyss? How did you find that pain and that fear?
I like Nora, and I root for her because she has remained really passionate about not only discovering herself, but also trying to bring more equality into her small world that she's gone out to explore. She's become successful. She's very opinionated. She cares about what other women in her same position are going through, let alone her now grown daughter, who she's surprised has a very different take on marriage than Nora.
Nora does meet her now grown daughter, and that's a scene where your character could really have come across as the villain. You know, here's the daughter she abandoned confronting her. What were your thoughts going into that?
That has always been a really tricky scene. Emmy is grown now and engaged herself. And in the 15-minute scene that we have together, it crackles with a lot of not passive-aggressive behavior, but it's two strangers who have some sort of a history. And the younger one is trying to not let on about whatever damage happened, maybe. And the mother is trying not to see what happened with these abandonment issues that the daughter's grown up with.
And I was just wondering, I know one thing about the stage, you have, you know, won Emmy Awards for your television work, and Chris is an Oscar for adaptation. But this is the stage. People wait for you at the door. Do they say to you, how could you, Laurie Metcalf? I mean, she left her children.
I have not heard that. Yeah. What it has done is sparked a lot of conversations between mostly married people. I guess I would hear from couples mostly. And a lot of people say that they want to come back and see it again because it's so dense and so the ideas are flying fast and furious. And like a sporting event, the crowd actually cheers when somebody lands a really good point. Mm-hmm. And there's so much humor in it. I know that the subject matter doesn't sound funny, but Lucas has done a wonderful job of making it so fresh.
And the demographic of people who are coming to this, a lot of younger folks who really, really relate to the daughter, Emmy, what Emmy has gone through, motherless, and those feelings of being abandoned. Unfortunately, there's a big group of young folks who really relate to that.
Because, does it sound funny?
Yeah. Well, you know, those are the two masks. Laurie Metcalf, Chris Cooper, both up for Tony Awards for their roles in A Doll's House Part 2, Lucas Nath's sequel to Ibsen's A Doll's House, rocking Broadway. Laurie, Chris, thanks so much for talking to us about it.
Thank you, Robin.
Sure.
Thank you.
A proposed $8 billion transportation spending package in Oregon could include a tax on the sale of bicycles to improve bike infrastructure. It's a funding idea that's often talked about, but no state has ever tried it. Chris Lehman of Here and Now contributor Northwest News Network reports.
Brad Welch works as an IT manager in Eugene, Oregon. He's been commuting to work by bicycle for more than 30 years, rain or shine.
It's a way to wake you up in the morning and kind of wind down after work when you leave. And then when you go out recreationally, you can enjoy the country.
Welch stopped in at Hutch's Bicycles in downtown Eugene for a quick fix of his brake handles. He says he wouldn't mind it if the state taxes bicycle sales, since the money would be used to improve the ride for bike commuters like him.
Everybody winces when they have to pay a little bit more, but overall, if I know it's going to a good cause, I'd certainly be willing to do it.
The bike tax is still being debated at the state capitol, but the current proposal would tack on 3% to the cost of a new bike. Under the current version of the plan, the tax would only apply to adult bikes that cost more than $500. The funding idea was the talk of the morning back in the repair shop at Hutch's. Mark Lipchick is a mechanic who also builds custom wheels for high-performance models.
It's going to hurt bike shop sales. It's going to put businesses out of business that are mom-and-pop bicycle shops, and a lot of people are going to be out of work as a result. It's really kind of silly.
But Lipchick's colleague, Carrie Adams, says he can see the need for better bike routes, even in a bike-friendly city like Eugene.
Overall, I think it's not a bad thing.
Around the corner at Wheelworks Bicycle Shop, owner Bill Cole pulls out a calculator to figure out roughly how much his shop would pay the state each year.
So you're looking at probably $18,000 we would pass on to the consumer.
Still, Cole says as a bike shop owner, he can see the benefit to giving potential customers more places to use the product he's selling. He's just not sure he trusts lawmakers to follow through.
The idea of having money going directly to support bicycling, I think, is a good idea. But once a tax gets started, it never stops, and it only increases.
Jarek Kransky is a lobbyist with the Street Trust, which until recently was called the Bicycle Transportation Alliance. His group is opposed to the bike tax.
We feel it's not an effective way to raise revenue. There's not a lot of money in the bike industry, and so we won't be able to generate the kind of dollars from a bicycle excise tax that would really have an impact on building new transportation infrastructure.
But if it does happen, Kransky says he wants to make sure the money is spent on the promised upgrades to bike routes. And he says the group might end up supporting the transportation package as a whole, especially if it includes funding for public transportation upgrades and safety improvements for pedestrians. Democratic Senator Lee Beyer helped craft the bike tax proposal. He says it came in response to a common refrain among lawmakers and the public.
They felt that bicycles ought to contribute to the system. Bicycle owners should contribute to the system, irrespective of the fact that most of them also own a car.
If it passes, Oregon would be the only state with a tax specifically for bicycles. It's been proposed in many places before, including in Oregon, but this year's version in Oregon has advanced further than previous attempts. For Here and Now, I'm Chris Lehman.
The Atlantic hurricane season started last week, and forecasters are predicting it will be more active than usual. But the next hurricane that hits the small town of Ile de Jean-Charles in southern Louisiana could be its last. The island is home to a small community of Native Americans, but it's sinking, and the state is now trying to move about 99 island residents to higher ground. Here and Now's Peter O'Dowd continues his series from the Louisiana coast with this report.
Since the middle of the last century, more than 90% of Ile de Jean-Charles has just dissolved into the bayou, and the people who still live here are barely clinging to what's left.
Hi, Rooster.
Rooster Falgo is working under the hot sun. He's outside his home, stooped over an ancient-looking lawnmower. With spare parts and tools around his feet, he says he doesn't want to leave.
I don't believe I got that much left.
You don't think you have that much left, so you just want to stick around?
81 left, you know. 81 years old, huh? So,
You're 81 years old.
Yeah, I'm 82, so...
But Rooster's wife, Rita, is ready.
It's totally different from when I grew up.
What's the biggest difference?
The water.
Rita Falgo says life here is becoming increasingly isolated. Last year, the state of Louisiana announced a $48 million grant from the federal government to resettle members of the island's Biloxi, Chitimacha, Choctaw tribe. The state predicts sea level rise and rampant coastal erosion will make Ile de Jean-Charles unlivable in the coming years. The road that connects it to the outside world is already crumbling into the water.
Across there, we could walk. Way back there, where you see the water.
I see a lot of water way back there. So you're just pointing off into the distance. I see maybe is that an oil well right there?
Past that.
You're saying that used to be all dry land?
Dry land. Mm-hmm. The oil companies started digging canals, and anyway, erosion. Erosion, like back there, the island is going under, and the whole thing's going to be underwater soon. Like another hurricane, and we're gone. If we have another one like Rita or Gustav, that's going to be it.
But it's not even just the hurricanes. It's like trying to cross that road that leads to the island. There was water on that when I crossed over today.
Yeah, and you see, my granddaughter used to live with me all the time, but she moved. It was too far from doctors and hospital. She's a diabetic. She couldn't stay here. She had to go. And so it's bad. And my husband, worried about him, see if he gets sick. And the road's flooded, but we're going to.
You want to get out of here as soon as you possibly can.
Yes.
Because you feel like the clock is ticking.
It is.
And it's not hard to see why she feels this sense of pending disaster. On a perfect blue sky day, I had to drive my car through a street flooded with ankle-deep water to meet one of the island's residents. Soon, the people who live here will be among the first climate refugees in America. But what happens to their culture and their way of life? Families grew up here sustaining themselves on the land that's given way to this.
People could hunt and trap. There were fruit trees, grapefruit, strawberries, tomatoes, anything you could grow.
Heather Stone is an oral historian at the University of Louisiana Lafayette, who's been speaking to people here about what they've lost and what they're about to lose. We met on top of the island's levee with a clear view of the water on the other side.
There was cattle on the island.
What happened?
A lot of different things. So about 100 years ago, when the Mississippi upriver, they started using levees and dams up there, it affected the drainage that came here, so there was no sediments to rebuild after storms. Mm-hmm. So the island started shrinking then. And then the storms would come and take chunks away.
In a way, it's beautiful. It's green, the water, the clouds, the sky, the fresh breeze coming off.
But this is why people want to stay.
This place isn't a crisis.
Yes. The peaceful feeling that you get here is a sense of place that you can't just go and find somewhere else. And it's in crisis because until the 1950s, the only way you could get here was by pirogue, which is a little canoe that's carved out of cypress. And you can't even get you don't even see any cypress trees that are alive here anymore.
All those dead trees that we can see right here on the inside of the levee are dead, and that's because of salt water.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Now the government has given this money to move people out of this community. You're an oral historian. You talk to people about this very thing, I'm sure. Mm-hmm. How do they feel about this idea of leaving this spot?
You know, this is a Native American community, the Biloxi, Chitimacha, Choctaw. And they've been here since the 1800s. During the Indian Removal Act, they moved here to get away from being moved to Oklahoma and further west and hid here and found and remade themselves here. So they were from internally in the U.S. where they did not fish, they did not shrimp, they did not do any of that. They came here and made a whole life for themselves. And generations have gone by and they've made it work. And now they will never be able to have cattle again, or the water's not going to be clean enough for them to grow on the ground. And if you came into my neighborhood, which haven't even been there more than 10 years, and said, I'm sorry, but it's not cost effective to save this neighborhood, I'd be like, what are you talking about?
There's just not enough people here to build the infrastructure that would protect it, essentially. It's not New Orleans.
No.
We understand that it's a really tragic set of circumstances that, you know, I think anybody would be emotional about.
Matthew Sanders works for the state's Office of Community Development, the agency responsible for resettling the island. Sanders says the move is voluntary. No one will be forced to leave. He says of the island's 29 households, all but three agree it's time to go.
As we build out a new community and we move them off the island, we want them to maintain continued access to the island and allow them to use it for recreational, cultural purposes. Until which time it goes underwater and there's no longer any access to it. And so we've talked about that in terms of a long goodbye.
And that goodbye will be here soon. The state has identified three potential tracts of nearby land on higher ground. Sanders says they're looking for a place that's similar culturally and historically to the home the islanders are leaving. The new houses will be raised up to protect against flooding. Construction could start next year.
I don't know that there's a comparable example of trying to pick up a community as a whole and move it wholesale. You know, there's not really a blueprint here that we can follow. So, I mean, we're part of what we're trying to do here is really create a model that can be scaled and replicated in other places. And so it's a learning opportunity.
I mean, there's no blueprint, but you may be making one and you may have to use it again, judging by how things are going down there.
Well, I think not only may we have to use it again, but we're certainly going to have to use it again. And so I mean, we understand in Louisiana that despite all of our coastal restoration efforts, despite all of our structural protection efforts, you know, we're going to lose land over time and we're going to incur a higher degree of flood risk. And, you know, we have communities that are just from a physical and environmental standpoint not going to be able to survive over the decades to come. And so you know, we can either sit around and wait for that degradation to happen over time or in an instant through a significant disaster event, or we can be proactive and work with those communities today and find some financially sustainable model by which we can pick people up and move them as a group.
There is an eerie sense of finality to all this.
Did he just go in?
For some people on the island, this is happening at the end of a long life. Wenceslas and Denicia Billiot are in their 90s and frail. They spend their afternoons on an elevated porch overlooking the levee, occasionally slipping into the French they grew up learning on the bayou.
I don't know if I want to move. I'm be gone before that the thing is not finished. Yeah, I'm 92. That's too old change place, huh?
But Denicia's husband says they will go. Ile de Jean Charles has changed too much.
I'm gonna miss this place. You see, when I was a boy, they had a marsh in there. They didn't have no water like that. You can go put a trap, get some muskrat,
raccoon, everything they had those days. But no more. Now everything is gone.
Everything but a few fading memories of home. For Here and Now, I'm Peter O'Dowd.
Today, President Trump kicked off a week of announcements about infrastructure, starting with a plan to privatize the nation's air traffic controllers.
Our plan will get you where you need to go more quickly, more reliably, more affordably, and yes, for the first time in a long time, on time. We will launch this air travel revolution by modernizing the outdated system of air traffic control. It's about time.
Trump has promised to kickstart the economy with a $1 trillion infrastructure program, but details remain scarce about how that might actually work. For more, we're joined by Derek Thompson, senior editor at The Atlantic. Hi, Derek.
Hi, Jeremy.
So the president's budget proposal sets aside $200 billion for infrastructure over the next 10 years, and the rest of that trillion, $800 billion, would come from private investment. I asked President Obama's former Transportation Secretary, Raila Hood, who was a former Republican member of Congress, about that approach, trying to leverage private investment through some public spending. Here's what he said.
I do think that public-private partnerships, the 3P program, is very, very important, particularly for the big projects. But in order to get to some of the other significant work that needs to be done in America on our roads, on our transit systems, with Amtrak, it will take increasing the gas tax. It will take infrastructure bank.
Derek, what do you think?
The big picture here is that the U.S. used to be the class of the world when it came to infrastructure and infrastructure spending. A long-storied history as a leader of highway construction, for example. Now we're closer to the bottom of the OECD, that list of advanced economies when it comes to public investment in infrastructure. And, you know, for a long time, people on the left, Democrats, have said, let's fix this. Let's spend more on roads and bridges and dams. But what's interesting is that Trump went even bigger than the Democrats. His infrastructure policy during the campaign was $1 trillion compared to $275 billion for Hillary Clinton. So he's the infrastructure guy here. But now that he's president and the White House has to deal with the fact that Republicans don't really want to raise revenue or spend more money, he has to take that $1 trillion promise and say, oh, no, actually, it's $200 billion of public spending plus $800 billion of private spending that's induced by the government. You know, it's possible that you can have a successful relationship like this, but the promise itself has clearly changed.
Well, what about that idea of trying to attract private investment? Does that work? Is a private organization or a company going to be willing to take on the risk involved in a dam or a railroad or even a highway and put up the money?
I think LaHood put it perfectly when he said that there are some projects for which a triple P, a public-private partnership, could be extremely appropriate. They tried it for buildings. They've tried it for parks. They've tried it even for bridges throughout the country. But there are other projects that simply won't work because you don't necessarily have the guarantee of long-term profits which are required for a private enterprise to want to get into the business of funding that. So, for example, with rail transportation, with Amtrak. Amtrak loses money basically all over the country. It makes a lot of money in the Northeast Corridor, where you and I both live. But for the rest of the country, it basically loses money. No rail company is going to want to build rails, understanding that it's going to lose money over many decades. And so in those places, you're going to need more public investment, and you can't get so clever about incentivizing the private sector to do so.
Well, one of the things that Trump has said he wants to do to incentivize the private sector to invest in infrastructure is to cut red tape. Gary Cohn, the president's chief economic advisor, has said he'd like to shorten the permitting process for new highways from 10 years to 2 or less. Would that make a difference?
It could make a little bit of a difference. Yeah, sure. I mean, there are definitely regulatory issues with the high cost American infrastructure. And it is rather remarkable. I was just doing a lot of reading on this over the past week, sort of anticipating that this infrastructure policy would potentially be in the news this week. U.S. infrastructure costs way more than it does in Europe or Japan. For some reason, and experts haven't really quite figured it out, it just costs a lot more to lay rails or build roads. You know, maybe it's the relative cost of wages with unions in America. Maybe it's the regulatory environment. Maybe it's other factors. But for some reason, the cost of actually building infrastructure in the U.S. is incredibly high, and we should get to the bottom of why exactly that is.
What is the biggest unanswered question for you about the president's infrastructure program at this point?
That's a great question. And the biggest unanswered question for me is whether this White House can follow through on any domestic policy that it dips its toe into. They said that they were all on board with Obamacare repeal, and then it seemed as if the president couldn't explain any of the details of that policy. He then said that he was getting ready to go sort of, you know, fully onto tax reform, right. And then they came out with their tax reform policy, and it was just like 100 words on a single page. So I'm looking forward to this administration really jumping into a public policy where it says we care about this and we're going to spend a long time trying to push this through Congress.
That's Derek Thompson, senior editor at The Atlantic, looking for details from the president. Derek, thanks.
Thank you.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.